Every summer in the rainy season, well, quote unquote rainy season, the Vasa retreat period, we have these Sunday talks. So there was not as much, say, forewarning for the titles this year. We're still trying to get everyone's names allotted to the particular Sundays. So we just have the first three pegged out at the moment, but we'll be publishing the full schedule in due course. So begin with the Namo Tassa three times. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So perhaps the people in the kitchen could be invited to end their conversation. Or join us out here. I apologize in advance for being a bit croaky. I had a very runny cold over the last couple of days, so I'm just coming around from that. Now, the theme for the first talk of this Vasa is what does it mean to be a Buddha? What does it mean to be a Buddha? So this seemed like a good way of opening the season's talks and reflections. We call ourselves Buddhists, or people who are interested in Buddhist practice, and we gather together. We call this a Buddhist monastery. But what do we mean when we use the word Buddha? And it probably means to say 50, 80 people, 100 people, perhaps listening to this, then they probably mean 50 or 80, 100 different things. So that the word has many different connotations or suggestions to different people according to our own backgrounds, our own conditioning. But in terms of the Buddhist scriptures and mythology, to be a Buddha is a part of a lineage. So the Buddha described himself as just being one in a succession of Buddhas from previous ages, way back into the mists of time. And so that he described how at various periods a fully enlightened being arises in the world and establishes a teaching, establishes a monastic order, and that teaching sustains itself in the world for a period of time, either shorter or longer. And in the Pali scriptures, in the Pali canon itself, the Buddha lists before him previous six Buddhas, the Buddha Vipassi, 91 eons, 91 kalpas ago, and then Sikhi and then Vesabhu. They were all in previous eons, previous kalpas. In this particular era, this particular kalpa, then which is called the fortunate kalpa, or one that is very blessed because of having had so many Buddhas, we have Kona-gamana, Kakusanda, Kassapa Buddhas, and then Gautama Buddha is the Buddha of the current age. So that speaking of these this kind of mythological framework, then the Buddha is saying that he did not particularly invent these teachings. He is merely the latest in a long line of beings who have rediscovered them. And he talked about it in terms of rediscovering an ancient path, like a path to an ancient city buried in the jungle, and rediscovering the pathway to that. And other scriptures after the time of the Buddha himself, later scriptures, they listed the even more Buddhas. So we do a protective chant called the Atanatiya Purita, where it goes back way before the Buddha Vipassi, Tanhankaro, to the 28 Buddhas previously, and a whole lineage from him. And then other later scriptures, you have 500 Buddhas. So it's like the longer after the Buddha actually lived, the more Buddhas are talked about. So in his own lifetime, he only talked about seven. In later, a few hundred years later, they talked about 28. few hundred years after that, they talk about 500. So I think in the general flow of religious conceptual proliferation, then things get sort of more kind of colorful and complicated and detailed as time goes by. But certainly within the Buddha's own lifetime, he spoke of himself as being part of this kind of lineage. So that in terms of the talk today and what I thought would be useful, there in respect to most Buddhist teachings and Buddhist stories, you have three different layers or three different levels. You have the mythological layer, you have the historical, and you have the psychological. So you would say the mythological format would be, you know, saying talking about Buddhas of previous ages and 91 kalpas ago. And, you know, a kalpa is from a big bang to a big crunch. So it's like a whole universe coming into being, reaching its limit, and then collapsing to nothingness, and then another universe arising, expanding, and collapsing. So we would call that the mythological framework. So most Buddhist stories have a mythological framework, and then you have the historical, that we know, even if people dispute, well, when exactly was the Buddha born? You know, what exactly did he say? We can be pretty sure that some very exceptional being lived in northeast India, was born in the northeast India, Nepal area, and spent quite a number of years traveling and teaching around that area, and has left a legacy of teachings for many, many people that have lasted to the present day. So there's a historical element, and most of the scholars debate around, you know, what is precise in terms of history, and, you know, say what exactly the Buddha taught and where exactly he lived and where exactly things happened. And then you have the psychological, which is to say, how does the figure of the Buddha and the teachings, how do they map onto our own psychology, our own internal patterns of experience? You know, how does that work? So that, I would suggest, and this is a helpful framework to consider, that you have in any Buddhist teaching, and most religious teachings, you have these three layers, the mythological, the historical, and the psychological, that interweave and inform each other. So that's what I thought would I present in particular today, and particularly the kind of the talking mostly about the mythological side, you know, what a Buddha represents in terms of principles, and then how that maps onto our own experience. So when we talk about the Buddha, what does it mean to be a Buddha? Then we have a series of characteristics that we recite. So that when we have the morning and evening chanting, we recite Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho Vicca Charana Sampano Sukato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisa Dhamma Sarati Satta Deva Manusanang Buddho Bhagava Ti. So these are called the nine qualities of the Buddha. So these are, say, describing the qualities of the Buddha as a spiritual entity, as a kind of mentor, as a spiritual example for us, and that these nine qualities, the first is arahang, there's a few different translations of these, so I took the liberty and precaution of writing these down. So some places arahang is translated as the pure one or the accomplished. Samma Sambuddho means a perfectly enlightened Buddha, one who has arrived at full enlightenment under their own as their own guidance, not through the influence or the kind of teaching structure or practices of another teacher. So perfectly self-enlightened. Vijja Charana Sampano means impeccable or perfect in conduct and understanding, perfect in knowledge and conduct. Sugato means the sublime one or the accomplished one. Lokavidu means the knower of the world, one who understands how the world works, one who sees the world clearly. Anuttara Purisa Dhamma Sarati. In our chanting books, that's translated as he trains perfectly those who wish to be trained, so the one who is the unexcelled teacher of those who wish to be taught. Sata deva manusanang, teacher of gods and humans. Buddho, one who is awake, enlightened. Bhagava, one who is holy or blessed. So we recite those qualities of the Buddha, and say these are the qualities of the Buddha, and we say recite those as an act of reverence, of gratitude, of respect, and to see this being who lived 2,500 years ago was an embodiment of those qualities. So when we ponder the question, what does it mean to be a Buddha? It means a Buddha is a being who embodies those particular qualities. And so there are also other lists of qualities like the 10 powers of the Buddha, which say encompass things like knowing what is possible and what is impossible, knowing the nature of all other beings, understanding the characters and dispositions of all other beings, also having the particular powers of seeing into past lives, seeing into the karmic streams of other beings, and also being fully liberated. So we talk about these particular qualities of a Buddha, and say a Buddha has these particular characteristics. We also say that according to the mythology, that a Buddha only arises in the world when all memory of the previous Buddha has disappeared. So that all memory of Kassapa Buddha and the teachings of Kassapa Buddha have disappeared from the world, and it's only then that the next Buddha, Buddha Gautama, has arisen. Also, within the lifetime of a Buddha, then there are these sort of certain mythological patterns whereby the town where the Buddha was born, the being enlightened under the Bodhi tree, having the two chief disciples, establishing a sangha, these are patterns that occur in the lifetimes according to the mythology of every single Buddha, whether it's Vipassi, Sikhi, Vesapu, Konagamana, Kakusanda, Kassapa. These are patterns that repeat themselves in a mythological form. So then, one of the interesting things then is to consider, well, we revere this great being, that we are here sitting in this place. This former school in Hertfordshire is now a place where we gather and we reflect upon the lifestyle established by this great being. We reflect upon the teachings that he left. If you consider 2,500 years ago, it was still the Iron Age here. This was 450 years before the Romans arrived. It's a long time ago. If you're aware of British history, it was still this is still the prehistoric era. It was out of the Stone Age, but it was the Iron Age. This was a completely different world. Where we are now in Hertfordshire, this was still just Iron Age civilization. It was a very, very different world. And here we are. We've gathered together from a person who was teaching in India at that time, 2,500 years ago. And we are living in a way that's guided by that person's insights, embodying the particular teachings that he gave, even wearing the same clothing that he established, that the pattern that our robes are sewn in, this is the longest lasting fashion on the surface of the planet. The Buddha, because in the early days, the nuns and monks used to wear robes put together by bits of scraps of cloth in whatever way the different the sizes of different patches were formed. They were just going to put it all together and make a basically rectangular wrap. And the Buddha one day was walking through the hills looking with Ananda and looking down over the fields, the rice fields in Magadha, and said, Ananda, see how the fields are laid out in strips, laid out in squares. And so Ananda, it would be good if you could design a robe that's made in that kind of a pattern, like the paddy fields of Magadha. So Venerable Ananda went off and drew up a design. And that's what we still wear. So here we are, 2,500 years later, wearing a fashion design from that was put together by Venerable Ananda 2,500 years previously. So we chant these words, Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama Sambuddho, and we recollect these qualities as a, to express our gratitude that these teachings have come down, that they can affect our lives so deeply and directly, so helpfully, that they are a way that we can live and say, establish our patterns of thinking in the current age that helps us and makes a big difference. Even in urban 21st century life, these teachings are still applicable and can be of direct benefit to us. So that's a miraculous thing. But in terms of making those teachings alive and really helping us, for most of us, it takes more than revering a great spiritual teacher from 2,500 years ago, that we might look up to that great being as an example and we might express our gratitude. But how does that really change our life? How does that really benefit us in a direct way? So I thought I would, I was pondering this theme, so I thought I would share with you a passage from one of Ajahn Chah's Dhamma teachings that relates particularly to this area, and that I feel is one of the most profound teachings that he ever gave. So probably most of you know this monastery, Amaravati, was established as a branch of Ajahn Chah's monastery. This is a painting of him up on the wall here. So he lived from 1918. He was born in June of 1918 and lived until January of 1992. And he established a style of practice and teaching that was as fully in accord with the Buddha's way as he could. And this monastery and about 380 others in Thailand and around the world are established according to the standards that Lumpur Cha put into place. And one of the reasons I feel that his teaching is so, has been so much appreciated and is so widespread is because of the practical applicability of that, the way he spoke. And also, he was very respectful and of the teaching, is very traditional, very orthodox in many ways, but also he was capable of bringing it alive and helping it to be applicable in a very direct way. So this is from a teaching of his that's entitled Dhamma Nature. In the collected teachings of Ajahn Chah, there's many of his Dhamma talks are put together in a single volume. So this is from the talk Dhamma Nature. The Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha exist in our minds, but we have to see it clearly. Some people just pick this up casually saying, oh, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha exist in my mind, yet their own practice is not suitable or appropriate. It is thus not befitting that the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha should be found in their minds, namely, because the mind must first be that mind which knows the Dhamma. Bringing everything back to this point of Dhamma, we will come to know that the truth does exist in the world, and thus it is possible for us to practice and realize it. For instance, Nama Dhamma, feelings, thoughts, imagination, etc., is all uncertain. When anger arises, it grows and changes and finally disappears. Happiness too arises, grows and changes, and finally disappears. They are empty. They are not any thing. This is always the way of all things, both mentally and materially. Internally, there are this body and mind. Externally, there are trees, vines, and all manner of things which display this universal law of uncertainty. Whether a tree, a mountain, or an animal, it's all Dhamma. Everything is Dhamma. Where is this Dhamma? Speaking simply, that which is Dhamma doesn't exist. Dhamma is nature. This is called the Satchatamma, the true Dhamma. If one sees nature, one sees Dhamma. If one sees Dhamma, one sees nature. Seeing nature, one knows the Dhamma. And so, what is the use of a lot of study when the ultimate reality of life, in its every moment, in its every act, is just an endless cycle of births and deaths? If we are mindful and clearly aware when in all postures, sitting, standing, walking, lying, then self-knowledge is ready to be born. That is, knowing the truth of Dhamma already in existence, right here and now. At present, the Buddha, the real Buddha, is still living. For he is the Dhamma itself, the Satchatamma. And Satchatamma, that which enables one to become Buddha, still exists. It hasn't fled anywhere. It gives rise to two Buddhas, one in body and the other in mind. The real Dhamma, the Buddha told Ananda, can only be realized through practice. Whoever sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. And how is this? Previously, no Buddha existed. It was only when Siddhartha Gautama realized the Dhamma that he became the Buddha. If we explain it in this way, then he is the same as us. If we realize the Dhamma, then we will likewise be the Buddha. This is called the Buddha in mind, or Nama Dhamma. We must be mindful of everything we do, for we become the inheritors of our own good or evil actions. In doing good, we reap good. In doing evil, we reap evil. All you have to do is look into your everyday lives to know this is so. Siddhartha Gautama was enlightened to the realization of this truth, and this gave rise to the appearance of a Buddha in the world. Likewise, if each and every person practices to attain this truth, then they too will change to be Buddha. Thus, the Buddha still exists. Some people are very happy saying, oh, if the Buddha still exists, then I can practice Dhamma. That is how you should see it. The Dhamma that the Buddha realizes is the Dhamma which exists permanently in the world. It can be compared to groundwater, which permanently exists in the ground. When a person wishes to dig a well, he must dig down deep enough to reach the groundwater. The groundwater is already there. He doesn't create the water, he just discovers it. Similarly, the Buddha didn't invent the Dhamma. He didn't decree the Dhamma, he merely revealed what was already there. Through contemplation, the Buddha saw the Dhamma. Therefore, it is said that the Buddha was enlightened, for enlightenment is knowing the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the truth of this world. Seeing this, Siddhartha Gautama is called the Buddha. The Dhamma is that which allows other people to become a Buddha, one who knows Dhamma. If beings have good conduct and are loyal to the Buddha Dhamma, then those beings will never be short of virtue and goodness. With understanding, we shall see that we are really not far from the Buddha, but sitting face to face with him. When we understand the Dhamma, then at that moment, we will see the Buddha. If one really practices, one will hear the Buddha Dhamma, whether sitting at the root of a tree, lying down, or in whatever posture. This is not something to merely think about. It arises from the pure mind. Just remembering these words is not enough, because this depends upon seeing the Dhamma itself, nothing other than this. Thus, we must be determined to practice to be able to see this, and then our practice will really be complete. Wherever we sit, stand, walk, or lie down, we will hear the Buddha's Dhamma. In order to practice his teaching, the Buddha taught us to live in a quiet place so that we can learn to collect and restrain the senses of the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. This is the foundation for our practice, since these are the only places where all things arise. Thus, we collect and restrain these six senses in order to know the conditions that arise there. All good and evil arise through these six senses. They are the predominant faculties in the body. The eye is predominant in seeing, the ear in hearing, the nose in smelling, the tongue in tasting, the body in contacting hot and cold, hard and soft, and the mind in the arising of mental impressions. All that remains for us to do is to build our practice around these points. So I'm also aware that Lumpo Cha told us never to prepare Dhamma talks. intending any disrespect to my revered teacher. I felt that this is an incredibly useful principles that he's put forth in that teaching. And so it's helpful to contemplate that, because it's a way that he would often speak. We can revere the Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago and look up, be grateful for his teaching, but the Buddha as a refuge, the Buddha as one of the aspects of the Triple Gem, we have to consider a refuge is a safe place. A memory or an imagined holy being of 2,500 years ago is not a safe place. It's not a genuine refuge. But what makes the Buddha a refuge? When we say Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, the words are not the refuge. The idea of the Buddha who lived all those years ago is not a refuge. It doesn't protect us. So what Lumpo Cha is talking about here is the Buddha which is the real refuge, the Buddha which is essentially the psychological aspect, the Buddha which is the aware aspect of our own minds. And as he says, when you You see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha. When you see the Buddha, you see the Dhamma. And saying everything is part of nature. So what aspect of your body or mind is not part of nature? Anybody come up with anything? Everything, mental, physical, spiritual, that we call ourselves or call the world around us, every single part of it is an aspect of nature. Even the microphone and the plastic that the cable is wrapped in, these all came from minerals in the ground or petrochemicals in the ground that are woven together and formed according to the laws of nature. The electricity that powers the microphone and that is recording all this, these are all aspects of nature. So that in Ajahn Chah's statements here, when he says present the Buddha, the real Buddha, is living, for he is the Dhamma itself, the Satchitamma. The real Dhamma can only be realized through practice. So the Dhamma is nature, and that every aspect of our being is nature, is that Dhamma. And one of the teachings that he quotes here and was used very, very often in his teachings, he would say, one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha, one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. And that comes from an exchange between the Buddha and a monk called Vakali, who was on his deathbed, and he was regretting the fact that he was too ill to go and pay his respects to the Buddha. So the Buddha heard about this and went to go and visit him in his kuti on the slopes of Isigili, I think near Rajagaha. And when the Buddha arrived at his kuti, then Vakali tried to get up and bow down before the Buddha, and the Buddha said, "Vakali, yes, be at ease. You sit, lie down. Don't bother yourself. Why are you struggling to get up?" And he said, "Well, I want to pay respects to you." And he said, "Well, why do you want to revere this filthy body? This collection of 32 parts. If you see the Dhamma, you see me. If you see me, you see the Dhamma." And that exchange between him and Vakali. If you can follow that, so the Buddha said, if you see me, you see the Dhamma. If you revere the Dhamma, you revere me. You don't have to be climbing off your bed and bowing down. That's just an external gesture. But if you really see the Dhamma, then you're seeing me already. You don't have to just make a special effort just because I've walked into your hut, into your kuti. Similarly, which also Ajahn Chah is referring to in this teaching, there's another sutta in the Itivuttaka called the hem of the robe, and the Buddha says, if a monk took hold of the edge of my robe, but his heart was filled with greed, hatred, and delusion, it would be as if he was living far away from me, for many hundreds of leagues away, hundreds of miles away. Even if he's hanging on to the edge of my robe and following me around, it would be as if he is far from the Tathagata. And comparably, if someone is living the other side of the Himalayas, they are physically many, many leagues away, but the heart is free of greed, hatred, and delusion, then it's as if they are sitting face to face with him. It's as if they are face to face with the Buddha, even though physically they're far away. So when we reflect upon this question, what does it mean to be a Buddha? Then in a way, it's not just talking about a mythological form or kind of a historical figure, but rather the quality. What does it mean to be awake? What does it mean to embody that quality within our own hearts, within our own minds? Because this is what Lumbu Cha would always point to. He said the Buddha that's a refuge is the Buddha that's alive here and now. And that the Buddha that's alive, that is accessible here and now, is the awareness of your own mind, the capacity that your mind has to be awake. that's the refuge. That's the safe place. So, like right now, so I'm just getting over a cold and a bit kind of sort of sneezy, clogged up, feverish, kind of yucky. Yesterday I was laid out flat for most of the day. So fortunately, I'm a little bit more energetic today. So If the mind takes refuge in the body and identifies with the body, then it goes, oh, I'm sick, I'm unwell, and I really want this to be over. This is really inconvenient. I've got to give the Sunday talk tomorrow. Am I going to be well in time? And the mind can get annoyed or worried or upset. But if there's awareness, then we recognize, well, I can be aware of this feeling of sneezing a lot and having a clogged up head, being sleepy and feverish. The mind can be fully aware of that and not make anything out of it. So, okay, well, it's only Saturday. I've got the other monks are taking care of the Asala Puja ceremonies at yesterday evening, that was. And so I don't have to think about it. I can leave that alone. And if I'm well by tomorrow, great. If I'm not well tomorrow, well, something else will happen. Somebody else will look after the Sunday events if I'm not able to. And so that in that moment, there can be a full awareness of the body being being ill or kind of unable to do much. And if the mind is not identified with that, it's a refuge, it's a safe place. As soon as the mind is identified with the body and the personality, with my gains and losses, comfort, discomfort, success and failure, then there's in a way, we're not the knower of the world, but the heart has been born into the world. We've become attached to the world. So the psychological aspect of being a Buddha is in a way the most important, and this is what Lumpo Cha would emphasize, that the Buddha the Buddha is alive. He's not just a historical figure to revere and to sort of pray to sort of help you get through your exams or before you go into the operation, Buddha, please help me. Yeah. I'm going under the knife. Please be kind. Like that's talking to an invisible deity is not really right way to understand Buddha Dhamma, I would suggest. But rather, the Buddha that is the refuge is that, oh, I can be aware as they put the anesthetic into me. I can be aware as they wheel me into the operating theater. I heard an interesting story when I was in Thailand about Lumpo Plien, who's a very highly revered meditation master. He lives in the north of Thailand near Chiang Mai. I was just in Thailand in June, and some of the monks I met had just been to go and see him. He's very ill right now and probably close to the end of his life, according to what these monks had to say. And they were recounting a story of Lumpo Plien a number of years ago. He's very highly regarded as a meditation teacher. And many years ago, he had this abscess in his leg. It was like an infection that just wouldn't heal up. And so the medical advice was that, well, you need to go and have an operation and kind of cut out all of the infected tissue and patch it all up and then let the leg recover with all of the infected tissue cut away. So he finally agreed to that because the thing was not healing up on its own. And then when he went to the hospital, he said, I'd like you to do the operation without any anesthetic. I'm interested to investigate the feelings. And I thought that would get your attention. Probably a few medical people gathered here. And so the doctor said, no way. We can't possibly do that. And he said, please, I want you, I'm the patient, please do it for me. And, you call yourselves my students and you respect me, so please, I'm asking you. So apparently they went back and forth a little bit on this. And then finally the doctor said, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put this tray of instruments. We'll do it without the anesthetic, but I'm going to put this tray of instruments on the top of your legs. And as soon as there's any movement in the instrument tray, as soon as we hear a sound of anything even rattling, then we're going to give you the anesthetic straight away. So apparently he got through the operation without twitching. And it was a kind of a big abscess, sort of fist-sized chunk they had to sort of carve out of his leg. And it was so nasty that when they released him from the hospital with a dressing on it, when he went back to his monastery and he was asked to give instructions to his attendant monks on how to change the dressing, yet two of his attendants fainted when they saw the hole in his leg. So he ended up having to change the dressing himself because his his upataks, his attendants couldn't cope with this kind of great gaping wound in the Arjan's leg. But he was apparently fine with it. So I acknowledge this is a bit of an extreme example, but that which also shows how the mind can take refuge in awareness, that there is a full attention, but a non-attachment, non-identification, even with intense feeling of that kind of scale, or that kind of nature. And the Buddha himself, in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, he makes the comment at the beginning of this teaching in the Digha Nikaya, about the end of his life. He says, "You know, I'm 80 years old. My body is like an old cart that's held together with strings and straps and wires. It's impossible for me to experience any kind of comfort." He said, if I'm paying attention to the body, then I'm in constant pain. So the only way I can experience any kind of comfort is to completely absorb my mind into emptiness. Yeah, if he's paying attention to the senses, then the predominant experience was one of pain. So even the Buddha had chronic pain. He didn't complain about it, didn't make a problem out of it, but he just casually mentions, you know, that's what he's experiencing whenever he's just paying attention to the body and the senses in the ordinary way. So this establishment of awareness, this is, as it was say, described there a little bit in the talk by Ajahn Chah, you know, this is a refuge that is available to us all the time. And insight meditation, vipassana, is essentially built around the establishment of that quality of awareness and the development of that as a refuge. So right now we can say, oh, we're sitting in the sala here at Amravati, and it's a Sunday afternoon Dhamma talk. It's fairly sort of benign, non-threatening, I presume fairly pain-free for most people. Maybe some of you got chronic pain, but you know, if so, then it's an even better example. So we can, in this moment, we can say, well, we're sitting in the sala here at Amravati. But actually, if you look at it in terms of insight, there's awareness of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch arising and passing away. We close our eyes, the visual world disappears. Open the eyes, the visual world reappears. You know, if I stop speaking, auditory consciousness switches off. If I start speaking, then the mind goes into picking up sound again. So that we are putting together our impression of the world moment by moment in this field of experience, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. As Ajahn Chah said at the very end of that talk, you know, all good and evil arise through these six senses. You know, this is where our practice is to be focused, because that's where experience is located. So that when we train the mind to be aware, to know, oh, this is seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. This is the world coming into being. This is being formed in this field of awareness right now. At that moment, there's the awareness, there's the quality of knowing, and there is the objects of awareness. There's a separation, a transcending. The mind is still aware of the world, but it's not entangled with the world. It's still fully participating in the world, and the words are flowing out of my mouth, and my mind is choosing what words to say next. There's an engagement with the world, but at the same time, there's a non-entanglement. So that this, the Buddha that is the refuge, is that very quality of awareness. Now, as you said, as Ajahn Chah pointed out, if we say, oh, the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, they're aspects of my mind. Like, so I am Buddha. Oh, wow, that means I'm already enlightened. Hey, great. Yeah, I can claim to be, you know, enlightened if the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha are already just aspects of my mind. But what he points out is like that the mind actually has to be fully in tune with reality. Otherwise, it's just an idea. Like I would spend a lot of years in California with this kind of the idea of being Buddha, and just all you got to do is just be aware, and just do whatever you feel like. As long as you're aware of it, then you're being Buddha. So that's a way to get into serious trouble, because you have the idea. It's like having a kind of plastic policeman's badge. You know, you can, Yeah, it looks like a police officer's badge, but you kind of stick it on your jacket, but it doesn't mean that you're a police officer. You got the badge, but it doesn't mean to say that you're qualified. So in the same way, the idea of, oh, the awareness of my mind is Buddha, hey, that's great, doesn't mean to say that your heart is totally free of greed, hatred, and delusion at all times. Be much easier if it was. It would be much easier if it was so simple. But the practice is a clarification, a purification, and say a freeing of the heart of greed, hatred, and delusion, so that innate quality of awareness, the capacity of the mind to know, is undistorted, is unbiased by personal preferences, by fears, by desires, by aversions, and our personal conditioning. Simple ways to approach this also that Lumpur Sumedho would often emphasize this theme, this area as a centerpiece of practice. And many, many years ago, back when the only monastery that we had in this country was at Chithurst, before any of the branches started up in Northumberland or in the West Country or any place, that in the very early days of Chithurst, Ajahn Sumedho used to often ask the question, what is it that Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know? What is it that Buddhas know? And you think, wow, the 10 powers of the Buddha, the Buddha knows all, he knows all of the karmic streams of every being around him. He's fully aware of all the different planes of existence. He can see back into the past, back into the time of Vipassi Buddha, or way back to Tathankara Buddha. The Buddha has this kind of cosmic vision and understanding of all things. So that's what the mind might imagine. But it was a deliberately kind of leading question. What is it that Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know? And then he would pause for a moment and he'd say, what Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know is that all that arises passes away and is not self. Oh, so it's kind of deliberately disappointing. You know, is that all? That is the essential thing, that the Buddha, what is it the Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know, is that everything is changing. And like exactly as Lumpur Cha puts it here, that what the Buddhas know is that everything is uncertain, every perception is changing, everything is in a state of flux, and the mind does not know what's going to happen next. It's uncertain. It can't create certainty out of what is intrinsically uncertain. So that another of Ajahn Chah's statements in a different Dhamma talk, he actually says this. He says, the Buddha is uncertainty. Again, they think, what? The Buddha is uncertainty. You think, well, that's a weird thing to say. He said, the Buddha is uncertainty because the truth of Dhamma is that all things are uncertain. Sabbe sankhara anicca. All things, sabbe sankhara anicca, are uncertain, are transient. That is the truth of the way things are in respect to all experiential reality. And if one sees the Buddha, one sees the Dhamma. One sees the Dhamma, one sees the Buddha. If the Dhamma is the truth that all things are uncertain, then the Buddha is that truth of uncertainty as well. So he would make this kind of statement, that the Buddha is uncertainty. One who sees, the mind that truly sees that everything is uncertain, is the Buddha mind. Now, you might be, on the one hand, you might kind of be prone to inflation saying, I'm the Buddha, I am pure awareness, that's what I am. One end of the scale. The other end of the scale, like me, oh no, I'm just this kind of ordinary, wretched person with kind of petty thoughts and all kinds of anxieties and irritations and opinions that I won't let go of, and I'm attached to my possessions and my house and my dog, and we kind of underrate ourselves. But these either overrating yourself or underrating yourself are both aspects of the mind. Say drifting wide of the middle, being say out of balance. But when the mind is awake to the middle way, then, and when there is the maximum quality of clarity, then there, without overestimating yourself or underestimating yourself, just recognizing, well, whether I like it or not, or whatever I make of it, the mind has this quality of awareness. And that awareness is not really a person. It knows success, it knows failure, it knows praise, it knows criticism, it knows gain, it knows loss. It's just this. It's simply this. And and whatever it knows is intrinsically in a state of change. So that simple reflection of Lumpur Sumato's, what is it that Buddhas know that unenlightened beings don't know? All that arises passes away and is not self. So on the surface level, it seems like a very simple statement, almost bland, like, oh, is that all? I can remember that. But to really know it moment by moment, knowing this feeling of the delight of success, the sweetness of success, of getting what you like, yes, the bitterness of losing what you like and or being criticized, or feeling loss or pain, to know, oh, this arises and passes away and it's not self. How could it be me and mine? Ha! Huh. So when the mind truly knows that and is fully aware of it, but unentangled in it, that is the awake mind, the Buddha mind. There's another exchange that is very, very significant in the Pali canon, where the Buddha met a Brahmin called Dona. And the story goes, it's in the sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, Dona was walking along the road and he saw the footprints in the dust of the Buddha. And he thought, wow, who, you know, what kind of a person left these footprints, these marks left in the footprints? Are so strange. He's got perfectly round marks like a wheel with perfect spokes. You know, who's got feet like this? This is amazing, and very, you know, symmetrical and strange in terms of the imprint that the feet made in the dust. So Dona, they kind of followed these footprints, and then they saw that they led off the road and into the forest. So he followed the footprints, and then he saw the Buddha sitting under a tree. And the Buddha was meditating, and Dona was extremely impressed. Like, wow, what kind of a being is this? That he was very, very tall, very serene, very radiant, sitting under the tree meditating. And so the Brahmin Dona kind of went up and kneeled down. And after a time, then the Buddha opened his eyes, and Dona spoke to him and said, excuse me, are you a deva? And he said, no, I'm not a deva. Are you a Brahma god? Said, no, I'm not a Brahma. Are you a yaka, a celestial demon? Said, no, not a celestial demon. Are you a tree spirit? No. Are you a person? No, I'm not a person. So, well, what are you? And so in that, I mean, he does, you know, are you a human being? Are you a person? And the Buddha says, no. So the Buddha can't lie. He's incapable of lying. So then Dona asks him, are you a human being? Are you a person? And he says, no. So that's interesting. So then the Buddha makes this comment, said, that whereby the Tathagata could be identified as being a Brahma or as a Deva or as a Yaka or as a Manusa, as a human being, has been cut off at the root, made like a palm tree stump, you know, completely abandoned and rendered incapable of arising in the future. You know, that the Tathagata has abandoned any form of identification, any kind of attachment, whereby he could be described by any of these forms. So then Dona says, so, well, what are you then? And the Buddha says, you can know me as one who is awake. Buddho smi, buddho asmi. Yeah. And that's probably the place where we get the word Buddha from, that very exchange. It's one of the sort of key, I mean, it's a unique little dialogue in the canon, but and the term buddho is used in the nine qualities of the Buddha, but it's a significant statement when the Buddha's asked, well, what are you? Buddho smi, buddho asmi. Yeah. That I am awake, or you can know me as one who is awake, or wakefulness. Now, another of the reflections that Lumpur Sumato would give that relates to this area that I think is very, very helpful is in terms of how we relate to our our mind, our personality, our life. And say, for example, you have a habit of being irritated, that you're complaining. Say, oh, I've got such a problem with complaining. I'm so critical. I'm always annoyed with people. I'm complaining. I'm criticizing people. Or maybe you're very lustful. You're going to keep falling in love with people, keep being obsessed by people. Or maybe you're afraid. You're a worrier. I've got a real worry problem. I feel just so anxious and fearful all the time. Or maybe you're very jealous, you have repeated issues with jealousy, being jealous of other people. I'm not, by the way, I always say I'm not not reading anybody's mind. So if you're thinking, how did he know? It's like, it's just statistics. I always say this. It's not psychic powers. It's just statistics. That's how we are as human beings. Some of us are going to be jealous types. Some of us are going to be lustful types. Some of us are going to be complainers. Some of us are going to be worriers. You know, that's how we tend to be. So we might think, I've got a jealousy problem, or I've got a lust problem, or I've got a fear problem. And then be very sincere and diligent in trying to work on my problem and thinking I'm being realistic, I'm trying to do what's necessary. And what Lumpur Sumedho would often point out is that, you know, in our very effort to work with these particular difficulties, we actually strengthen them. We reify them. We make them real, this because of saying, me and my problem. I've got this fear problem. I've got this jealousy problem. I've got this anger problem. And so that unconsciously, unwittingly, we are making there a real substantial I, who is the genuine owner of this substantial thing, this me who has this problem. And the mind creates this idea, if there was me without the problem, me without the jealousy problem, me without the anger problem, me without the fear problem, wouldn't that be great? Seems reasonable enough. And many of the texts that we read seem to describe that or encourage that. But what he would point out is that in the very way the mind frames it, it reifies the difficulty. And the more it's me and my problem, the no matter how hard we try to work, the more it seems to strengthen it, make it impossible to work with. So he would suggest what he would call the paradigm shift, changing the paradigm from me and my problem to the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, or the awake mind seeing the way things are. And so that, again, it might sound a little bit inflated or sort of hyperbolic, say the Buddha seeing the Dhamma. I'm not a Buddha, I'm just this person with a anger problem. But Buddha in this respect, maybe Buddha with a small b, the awake mind, as Ajahn Chah says, the Buddha in mind, the awake mind that knows the feeling of complaining or feeling of lust or the feeling of fear, the feeling of jealousy. Now, even though we might say, I'm jealous all the time, or I'm always lustful, I'm always angry, what Lumpur Sumedho would point out is that we tell ourselves that, but it's really not true. If you look, yeah, maybe it's a repetitive pattern, but it's not there all the time. And that even if you see it as like a strong habit, in nobody's experience does it really exist all the time. It arises and passes away. In fact, one of Ajahn Chah's meditations on anger, and this is an interesting practice, just as an aside, he said, rather than trying to practice loving kindness to get rid of anger, practice anger. Think an angry thought and sustain it for an hour. And as soon as your mind stops feeling angry, let go of the non-angry thought and reestablish the anger. And you try and do that, and it's virtually impossible. You know, I tried it a couple of times, and to try and stay angry for an hour is really hard work. By the time you get to the end of the hour, it's like, oh, phew, thank goodness that's over. So you might try that as an extra practice. But going back to the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, so then what this is doing is like saying, yeah, well, there's, rather than I've got a fear problem, which is what I found I was most intensely working with in those days. This is back in the mid-80s, in the late 80s, when Lumpur Sumedho was teaching here at Amravati. Would be, say, yeah, it's true, actually. Amazingly enough, the teacher is correct. I say I've got it. I'm always worried. I'm always afraid. But it's not true. There's times when I forget that altogether. I'm brushing my teeth or on my way somewhere, and then suddenly I realize, oh, I've forgotten to be worried. And you realize, oh, it's right. It does. It arises and passes away. And that suggestion of changing the paradigm, going from me and my problem to here is the awake mind seeing that this feeling arising and passing away. It was not like some kind of special mind filter being overlaid on top, but rather it was peeling away the filters of presumption and supposition and habit and seeing what was already really there. That actually, yeah, that's not like something I'm adding to it. It's really when you peel away the layers of habit and delusion, here is the aware mind seeing this pattern of feeling arising and passing away. Oh, that's what's always been happening. So that there's always just been this quality of awareness, knowing fear or jealousy or desire or aversion, whatever it might be, arising and passing away. And when that paradigm is shifted, and that there's a quality of the letting go of the personalizing habit, the letting go of the I and me and mine, and seeing it in terms of here's the awake mind, the Buddha mind, seeing the way things are, there's a spaciousness, there's a naturalness. So even though the what's being experienced might be quite unwholesome or painful, there's a spaciousness around it. There's not that kind of stress of identification. There's seeing, oh, well, fear arises and passes away. There's a body, there's a mind. Fear is going to happen. Aversion is going to happen. Jealousy is going to happen. So it doesn't have to be seen as a problem. It doesn't have to be seen as me and mine. So this I found was a tremendously helpful and practical teaching. So when we reflect on this theme, what does it mean to be a Buddha? It doesn't have to be some sort of theoretical idea or just talking about an idealized mythological being, but to be a Buddha, with a small b, you know, to be a Buddha is to be that awareness that is able to know the arising and passing of all things. And the in that being Buddha, then there's a tremendous freedom. When we, maybe one of the last thing to share, then before we have break for tea and stretch our legs and such like, when we consider that quality of awareness, then we see how the mind tries to turn that into an object or make that into something. But just like the Buddha said to Dona, you know, that whereby the Tathagata might be identified as a deva, or as a yaka, or as a brahma, or as a person, has been abandoned by the Tathagata. There's a similar exchange that the Buddha has with Vachagota. When Vachagota has been, as a wanderer who's been asking the Buddha about what happens to an enlightened being after the passing away of the body, then the Buddha speaks about his own internal experience in a very, and his own way of relating to the body and the experiential reality. He said, and talking about his own experience, so he said, Vacha, yeah, that material form of feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, whereby one trying to describe the Tathagata might describe him, that has been cut off at the root, made like a palm tree stump, has been completely relinquished and rendered incapable of arising in the future. You know, the Tathagata is liberated from being reckoned in terms of material form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. You know, the Tathagata, you can't reckon it, you can't form it. You say, well, what is that awareness? Is it male, female, tall, short? Does it have a nationality? You know, is that the Tathagata, or you can say your own, that awareness of your own heart is liberated from being reckoned in terms of material form, feeling, perceptions, mental formations or consciousness. The Tathagata is profound, boundless, immeasurable, like the great ocean. So to take as a final reflection, then you said that you can hear in this teaching that the Tathagata is that aware, awake quality is, it has a substantial reality, but you can't describe that in terms of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, or any of our normal reference points. So the Buddha just says it's immeasurable, unfathomable, boundless, like the great ocean, which is very frustrating to the thinking mind. but I want to know, I want to have a definition. But it's frustrating to the thinking mind, but if you notice, it's also liberating to the heart, that this heart, this aware, awake quality can't be defined, can't be determined or formed in terms of our normal language and thinking, in terms of our normal imagination. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this afternoon. So we can have a break now for a quarter of an hour or so, and I suspect the tea makers have been busy, and the doors are opening, yes, and we can reconvene about 20 past for the questions and answers and Dhamma discussion.